Ken, how big of a deal is this?
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I just don't think the listener has any question about what was the big issue this week.
Clearly, it seems to be the fact that the Democrats don't have a lieutenant governor nominee in Illinois. And Pat Quinn is going to obviously have to run with some Democrat, and they're going to decide this weekend. And I think that's captivating nobody.
You think that's bigger than Evan Bayh giving $1 million to Brad Ellsworth as the Democratic nominee in Indiana?
I heard Dan Senior is not going to run for the Senate in New York.
I think the Dan Senior story is a real contender. But I see here on our prepared script by our ace producer, Evie Stone.
Wait. All this time we've had prepared scripts?
I'm sorry, I've never shared them with you. But I see here on the prepared script that has my name on it in big block letters that we should be talking about healthcare.
There is anger out there that is manifesting
itself.
There's
anger in there.
Yes.
There were members of the House who went up into the gallery and took the signs of the protesters who were being essentially detained and taken out and held those signs up in the place of the protesters.
And remember, the incendiary language we've heard goes back to at least last September when Joe Wilson...
You lie!
He yelled at "you lie" during President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress. We had Alan Grayson of Florida, the Democrats, saying that Republicans want you all to die.
That's their health care program.
Right, health care program. So, I mean, the language has escalated and escalated to the point where there have been racial and homophobic epithets yelled at members of Congress. One member, African-American member of Congress, was spat upon.
And there have been messages sent to many members of Congress, threatening messages. There were apparently nooses, drawings of nooses that were sent to Jim Clyburn.
Bricks thrown through windows.
House Democratic Whip, number 3 ranking officer in the House, who is African-American. And also pictures of gallows sent to Bart Stupak, who became, in some respects, the poster boy for a lot of the opposition to this bill when he changed sides and said, all right, the president's executive order on abortion is enough for me. I don't have to have my language in the bill.
Bart Stupak was getting hate mail
from the other side.
Exactly.
So ugly.
And also Tom Perriello, the Democrat from Virginia, a Tea Party group put up what they thought was his home address, and it actually was the address of his brother, and it turned out his brother's gas line was severed.
This is the issue. The issue is, you know, the Democrats can ask for protection. They're going to get protection for some period of time. Some of them are going to ask for physical protection. There are, as a matter of course, a certain number of threats that are made against members of Congress. That's just sort of background
every day.
Noise. Every day,
right.
Back through the
but
ages.
That's true.
But there has been a spike, no question. A lot of reporters are going to be out there looking for these things. We're going to talk a lot about it. It's kind of a distraction in a lot of respects from important information that needs to be getting out about what's actually in this bill and what's actually happening with it. But it is lurid, and a lot of people are talking about it. And I guess the other thing is you hope that this sort of talk does not encourage this kind of behavior and take it to another level.
But the reason, yes, I agree with you completely, and of course this should be overshadowed by the importance of what was passed, but the reason I bring this up is because there seems to be, even if it's just temporary, somewhat of a change in public opinion or public impression about the bill. Prior to the bill, polls showed that a plurality of voters were opposed to the health care bill. Of course, everybody likes health care, but, you know, polls
they didn't like the bill.
Whatever they want. But there was a USA Today Gallup poll right after its passage showed that 49% now approve of the fact that Congress passed it.
Still shy of half, of course.
But compared to 40% who oppose, although the enthusiasm level is not that great.
The enthusiasm is rather weak, whereas the animosity is extraordinarily intense. At least that's the initial showing after the bill was first passed. And we have had a lot of talk about the polls back over weeks and months, but 2 points that I think that came out in the immediate aftermath of this were, first of all, that the disjunctivity of this had seemed to be closing. That as people focused on it more and watched the debate, there was a little bit more support for the bill, a little less opposition. But also there was one poll, and I only saw one poll that did this, which surprised me, because this would seem like a natural question to ask. But CNN, on one of their polls, said, do you like the bill more or less the way it is, or do you oppose it because it's not liberal enough? Or do you oppose it because it's too liberal? Now, of those three answers, the most popular was, it's too liberal. But if you put together, I like the bill the way it is, plus those who thought it should be more liberal, in other words, maybe single payer or at least having a public option, that combined score got over 50%. That was a surprise, I think, to a lot of people.
And I also think there was a certain swagger in the Democrats starting with Sunday night's vote, because it seems like Democrats were really walking around pretty defensively in the last couple of weeks, sensing that, you know, President Obama was not fighting for the bill strong enough. I mean, when Scott Brown was elected January 19th, everybody said health care was dead, Obama didn't live up to his promise, blah, blah, blah. As it turned out, Nancy Pelosi did exact a pretty impressive victory. She never gave up.
And she always insisted on going for the big bill.
Right.
There were a lot of people in the White House,
Rahm Emanuel,
including Rahm Emanuel and perhaps the president himself, who after the Scott Brown debacle said, hey, we're not going to get the big bill, let's go incremental. But Nancy Pelosi said, uh-uh, don't think that that's going to help us. We'll still get criticized for the big bill, even if we pass a little one. Let's get hung for stealing sheep instead of for stealing goats.
So the reason I mention the spitting and the epithets and the vandalism is because if there is a sea change in public opinion towards the bill, this is also the kind of headlines. And as you say, journalists search around for these kind of incidents. The more we hear about it, the more perhaps there was a turnabout in how people view the bill.
You mentioned Bart Stupak and the battering that he's been taking from left and right. Now, that extends into his primary and his November prospects, too.
Bart Stupak, who's in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, has won with at least 65% the last four times out. He's never been seen as endangered at all. Yet, actually, a couple of weeks ago, he was hit by a primary from the left. Even though Bart Stupak eventually came on board, voted for the health care bill, Connie Saltonstall, who's a liberal Democrat from the district, says, I have no objection to the fact that he's feels this way about abortion, but the fact that one person could have held up this bill for so long and tied all of us in knots for so long, it's just unacceptable. And so she's running against him in the August primary from the left.
Do you think she continues?
She does. There's a lot of anger. She's already been endorsed by NARAL, by Planned Parenthood, by Emily's List. So I think groups on the left.
So Bart Stupak should be pretty safe from that challenge.
Well, look.
In that district. Those are not groups that move a lot of vote.
It could bring money. But perhaps the more nerve-wracking for Stupak, perhaps it's too early, is the fact that the pro-life groups have really felt that he's a Judas. He betrayed them after promising that to hold out and coming through at the last second. And so there was a Republican challenger, Dan Beneshek, a surgeon, first-time candidate. But he is being supported by a lot of pro-life conservative groups who feel that Bart Stupak sold them out.
And there's going to be a real test of Bart Stupak in that. And do you think Stupak anticipated that from the very beginning? Do you think he thought that he would eventually be a no vote, or do you think he always thought he was going to be a yes vote?
That's a good point. A lot of people feel that he sold out for other things, that the administration promised him something, Nancy Pelosi promised him something. I think there was certainly something sincere about Stupak. I mean, he didn't take the popular view. He was not the most popular Democrat in Washington. He's been under a lot of pressure, been jeered at by fellow Democrats for months, having almost held up the bill in November, and then again by threatening to withhold his supporters now. So not the most popular guy, and I really think it is more principle with him. And one more thing to add to talk about the political fallout. Many of the Democrats who voted no on the health care bill back in November and switched to yes vote on Sunday, they have energized the Republican base in their district. Betsy Markey of Colorado, for example.
Giffords from Arizona.
Gabriel Giffords, Tom Perriello, as we mentioned, in Virginia.
These are all people who won very narrowly in what are usually Republican or frequently Republican districts. Many cases voted for John McCain in 2008, where the Tea Party and more conventional Republicans are highly active. Places where they would have had a tough first re-election under the best of circumstances. These people have cast some pretty tough, pretty gutsy votes on this bill.
And there are also some Democrats who could be in trouble from the left wing of their party. Michael McMahon of Staten Island has been threatened by Andy Stern of the SEIU of an independent candidacy. Jason Altmaier of Pennsylvania also, who had voted no, Labor in his Pennsylvania district, is looking at perhaps either a primary. It's probably too late for a primary challenge, but a third party challenge in November. So Democrats are being hit from the left and right, depending on which way they voted.
Now, this we have talked about many times already leading up to this vote, but it takes on a new kind of reality now that the bill has actually become law. And it literally has not only passed, it has become law. The president has signed this into law since last we had a podcast.
As a matter of fact, I remember, if memory serves, Joe Biden was very excited about it.
Okay, we've been talking about the impact of health care on the November elections for months now. Now we have a law. What's the difference? Isn't this going to make some difference for the Democrats in the sense that now, instead of defending themselves against every criticism of an imagined piece of legislation, people will actually get a sense of what the reality of this bill is. And so the Democrats can say, wait, before you believe this is government takeover, look at what's actually changing and not changing.
And I suspect that much of it will not be changing. I don't think anybody's going to go to the polls in November and see that their lives have changed because of what happened last Sunday night. I suspect that the issue will still be jobs and the economy and the unemployment figures, and that's still something that Democrats have to wrestle with.
If this recedes a little as an issue, and if the economy picks up, is it possible, and we talked about this, I think, just last week, is it possible that the enormous amount of energy that the Republicans have put into this and the particular way in which they've characterized the issues, government takeover, death panels, things of that nature, will have some sort of backlash effect for them?
Well, sure, it's possible, but look what's happened in the past year. Last year at this time, everything was going the Democrats' way. The Republicans were floundering and all that stuff. And then flash forward to January when Scott Brown won, and then we said, oh, every Democrat in the world is in trouble. So these trends that we think are going to last for a long time can switch on a dime.
Well, we already saw it. We saw the spring, as you described, right after inauguration, sort of, if you will, the Obama spring. And then there was the Tea Party August, when the town halls turned against the Democrats, and a lot of people at that point got enormously frightened about what the consequences of health care might be. The president gave a speech in September that helped him a little bit. They seemed to be on a roll. They got the bill through the House. They got the bill through the Senate.
Don't forget the November elections, when independents always seem to swing towards the Republicans.
And people said they were worried about the health care bill. So that put some fear in the Democrats. Then in December, they got it through the Senate, but purchasing, if you will, each of the last several votes on their way to 60, ruining what might have been left of the reputation of the Democratic leadership, and also to a large degree of the bill, making people think that somehow this was illegitimate, some sort of boondoggle.
Which is exactly the way every bill is passed in Congress, by
Well,
the way.
That's true, but then if you looked at each one with a microscope, the way people looked at this bill passing in the Senate in December, you would probably get negative images of the bill and the process similarly in those cases. Then we had Scott Brown. And then we had the fallout from Scott Brown, and every pundit in Washington agreed that they couldn't possibly pass health care now, and here we are. So perhaps the best prediction we can make is that all predictions will change in a period of weeks and months.
Absolutely. But here's one other thing that may be changing as well. Scott Brown's victory, for how you want to define it and characterize it, Scott Brown was pretty much a moderate, mainstream kind of Republican, whereas, for example, what's going on in Utah this week is hardly the same kind of Scott Brown role.
Exactly. Here's Robert Bennett, who anyone in Washington, I think, would characterize as a conservative Republican.
Absolutely.
He is the son of another conservative Republican who served in the same seat.
Wallace Bennett.
And he is, in a sense, the embodiment of a kind of establishmentarian Republicanism. But that seems to be exactly his problem. Back in Utah, the safest of safe Republican states, he's in trouble because he's seen as too much of an establishment Republican who voted for the bank bailout back in 2008. That's
right.
The big issue. He voted for the bank bailout.
Tarp
he saved the banking system. And therefore, there are thousands of activists who are going to these meetings and electing people at the capillary level of their renominating system and actually endangering the renomination of their three-term Republican Senate incumbent.
Actually, we've seen that in Utah many times. A lot of Republicans that we think nationally are pretty much conservative, Orrin Hatch, John Huntsman, the former governor, they've all been up against major challenges for their renomination. Chris Cannon, another member of Congress who was very, very conservative, was beaten by Jason Chaffetz last time because he wasn't conservative enough. It seems like the conservative darling in Utah now is a guy named Mike Lee, a former clerk for Justice Samuel Alito, who in the early numbers seems to be doing very, very well against Bennett. Again, and this may be just endemic to Utah, but look, it's a conservative party. The Republicans are conservative. We know that. But they may be just too conservative, again, to attract that big, huge centrist middle that they desperately need for November.
And which they did attract in 1994. So we'll be talking between now and November about what is similar and what might be dissimilar between this year and that year, 1994. One thing, we always have to touch base on what's going on in the, if you will, somewhat soap opera politics of Texas. Kay Bailey Hutchison, who ran against their sitting governor, Rick Perry, for the gubernatorial nomination of the Republican Party, did not win. And now her career would appear in some sense to be over. She had promised to quit the Senate if she won or lost in that primary. And now she has lost, and yet she is not quitting. And suddenly, all the Texas Republicans are saying, Kay, won't you stay?
All 20 Republicans in the Texas congressional delegation have said, please don't leave. A lot of them, like Joe Barton, would love to be senator themselves.
I thought Joe Barton wanted her hair so bad. sadly, he would be the one guy who held out and said, no, okay, look, you know, if you want to retire, it's a good time to do it.
And maybe she doesn't run again when her term is over in 2012, but they don't want her to quit in the middle with a special election, even though John Cornyn may not be the biggest fan of Kay Bailey. They don't want to spend a lot of money on a seat that they would not have to defend in the middle of this topsy-turvy year. So there is pressure on Kay Bailey Hutchison to stay. Perhaps it's a safe, face-saving thing for Hutchison, because clearly she was always ambivalent about leaving to begin with.
And speaking of soap opera, we surely cannot end a podcast without spending at least a minute on your favorite state. Ken, what's going on with New York?
Well, it's not my favorite state, but it is the state of my birth. Well, first of all, in the race for governor, about a week ago, we only had one Republican candidate, Rick Lazio, who was raising no money, getting very little respect. He was a guy, of course, who, as we mentioned in the podcast last week...
Sign it.
Just sign it. Against Hillary Clinton in 2000. Now, he hasn't run for office since. He thought he was going to be the anointed Republican. Last weekend, he got the nomination of the Conservative Party, but that's still not enough. Steve Levy, the Democrat, even though a conservative Democrat, the Democratic County Executive of Suffolk County on Long Island, is in the race. Very anti-illegal immigration, very populist. And there's also a millionaire from Buffalo, Carl Palladino, who says he's going to spend $10 million of his own money in the race. And if he doesn't get the nomination, he may form his own third-party Tea Party candidacy. The Republicans are not united, and yet they think they have an opportunity in New York, even with the Gillibrand seat.
Well, but at least they finally unified behind a candidate to run against Kirsten Gillibrand for the Senate. Dan Senor here. We just said so last week on our podcast, didn't we, Ken?
No.
Dan Senor, former spokesperson for the Pentagon.
The Republicans are not having a Senor moment. Dan Senor announced this week that because of obligations to his family, this is not the right time for him. Ron, how many people, by the way, have said that they are going to run against Kirsten Gillibrand and ultimately decided not to run?
And all of them saying it's because of the obligations they have to Dan Senor's family.
That's right.
Never been able to figure that out. We cannot let this podcast end without noting the passing of one of the two men for whom this podcast was really founded and dedicated.
Stuart Udall?
Robert Culp.
Robert Culp.
Who died this week, the actor who brought us at least one half of the buddy team on I Spy in the mid-1960s that saved television.
Ron, are you comparing Robert Culp and Bill Cosby to Ron Elving and Ken Reardon?
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from BFD.